I think it's the quality of the comment that is made versus the number of times a comment is made. If there is one person that makes a very significant, well-thought-out comment, the board will take that into consideration, even if they were the only individual who made that comment. But we always hope that many more people will comment on our standards and concept releases.
Kind of as a follow-up to what Wayne just mentioned, it seems to me that if only two responses represented investors, I would perceive from that there's a high level of ambivalence among the investors, and that therefore I'm not sure if there's a reason to move forward with this. Obviously, the audit firms are probably pretty dead set against it, and if the investors don't seem to think it matters, why are we talking about it?
This is Barb Roper. Could I comment quickly on that?
Yes, Barbara.
I just think that's not an assumption that you can make from that low number of responses. I think if you looked across the issues that the board addresses, the sad fact is that there is consistently a low number of investor responses, and that it is a mistake to assume that that reflects ambivalence. I think it's as likely to reflect a lack of awareness on the part of the public about this process, rather than anything definitive about what their views would be if they were more aware.
Galen Hansen.
During the Treasury Committee proceedings and the testimony, the investors felt very, very strongly about this. So maybe we only had a couple of comment letters, and that would be consistent with what Barbara had just mentioned. We've been over these arguments. I didn't hear any new arguments in the comment letters that we heard during the testimony that came before ACAP or in the discussion that we had last year, or maybe it was the last SAG meeting on this particular issue. But we've been doing what we have for the last 100 years, and if we keep doing things the way we always have, then why would we expect a different outcome? And perhaps it might be time to try something a little bit different. But I found the comment on the idea that we're going to have a shortage of partners willing to sign audit reports particularly, I don't even know how to respond to that. I just don't see that happening, that people are going to be not willing to step up to the plate, and there'll be a shortage of partners. I don't see that happening.
Joe Carsello.
Well, I was involved with one of the comment letters, so how I feel is known. So I'll try to keep what I say brief, because there's so much that you said I could respond to. First, in response to Paul, there were only two investor groups that commented. I would point out that one of those investor groups is essentially an umbrella investor group. Jeff may want to pipe in here at some point. But that investor group controls, or the membership of that investor group has $3 trillion of assets under management. And the other investor group that commented, or other investor, has $200 billion. Of assets under management. So these are very, very significant investor groups. The second point I would make is I would encourage the board to look at the comment letters from the firms were very good. They obviously have very bright people who spend time writing very good comment letters. But in fairness to the firm people, they have a vested interest in this debate. And the two investor groups are the customer of the financial reports and of the auditor report. And the academics really have no obvious vested interest. And of the five, four of the five were unequivocally in support of this recommendation. And only one of the five was somewhat, I would say, both pro and con in that comment letter. I think the board should look at the quality of ACAP, as I talked about this morning, the membership of that group. I would point out that the United Kingdom has already implemented this. The United Kingdom has not only implemented this, they have implemented or are on the way to implementing audit quality indicators. They have firms filing financial statements. I just wrote a comment letter this weekend on independent members of firm governing boards, which they have a concept release out on, which is also part of ACAP. So it would appear to an outside party that in terms of what investors want, the United Kingdom is leading and the United States is lagging. As an American citizen, as an investor, that makes me uncomfortable. I would agree with the firms that I think in most cases this will not matter. If we were to look at the partners in this room, these are all people of high integrity and high competence, and I don't think it would make any difference on the audits they do. But I do think it could matter in the tails. I won't go into too much depth, but there have been enforcement actions by the PCAOB against some individual partners. In my opinion, somewhat egregious cases of knowing behavior. And if that person had to sign his or her name, would it have been different? It's hard to prove in advance, but it certainly might. It's obvious that the firms are against this. The one argument that they made that I do agree with is I do think it's important to craft whatever you do here so as to not increase legal liability on the part of individual partners. I think there's enough legal liability, so I don't think they need more legal liability. So I think that's a fair argument. Some of their other arguments I thought were pretty weak, but I think that's a fair argument. And given the opposition by the firms, I think I have a very simple solution for you, and that is the United Kingdom has implemented this requirement in 2008. As of December 31st, 2009, you're going to have 2 years of data. Study the data. See what happens. Does mean behavior change? Does the variance change? What are the outcomes, both good and bad, of this requirement? Talk about a petri dish. Short of Canada, the United Kingdom is going to be about as close as you're going to get. And so I think that could be very informative to the board.
Thank you, Joe. Jeff Mahoney?
I think Joe just covered every point I was going to make, but maybe I have a couple more, so thank you, Joe. Just a couple to add on. One of the individuals who brought this to the attention of the committee, very prominent accountant that we all know, his name isn't a report, so I'm not going to name him, but worked for a Big Four accounting firm. I asked him if he was on the Treasury Committee, what is the number one thing that he would recommend, and this was his idea. Former Big Four partner, internationally known, very well respected. I've also had conversations offline with Big Four auditors on this point in the arguments, and I get a little bit different story than what you recited in the letters. I've heard all the arguments as part of the Treasury Committee, and I find most all of them very weak. I would also point out on the legal issue, I agree with Joe on that. The committee discussed that. We had some very prominent attorneys involved in that process. You'll see in the Treasury report that they indicated that this could be done without imposing additional liability on auditors, with language similar to language that was used for Section 407 on Audit Committee Financial Experts. That's footnote 87 in the Treasury report. Thank you.
If there aren't any other comments, we will move on to our next topic on fair value measurements and the use of specialists.
I hope you found this helpful, that we will, from time to time, as we have standards that we're proposing or concept releases that are outstanding, as we get comments, we'll try to share it with the SAG to try to keep you updated as we're moving ahead with our standard setting, and to bring that before the SAG and see if there's any further input that we can get from you in our thinking. So I found it useful, and I hope you all did as well. So as Bella mentioned, the next subject on our agenda is auditing fair value measurements and using the work of a specialist. There's probably a few subjects that have been discussed more in the past couple of years than fair value measurements. And we've been looking at our auditing standards in this area for a while. We've had some discussions on this before the SAG before. And we're moving ahead with our thinking in terms of proposing a standard on fair value measurements in the use of specialists. And we thought as we did that, this was a good time to come back to the SAG with some of the issues and topics we're facing as we're moving forward. Greg Fletcher, Associate Chief Auditor, is going to share with us some highlights of what we're going to be talking about for about the next 30 minutes or so, and then we'll take a break, and then SAG members and observers will move to breakout sessions. Greg?
Hey, thanks, Marty. Well, in this session, we'll discuss the potential direction of some standard-setting projects on auditing fair value and using the work of the specialists. I'd like to provide an overview of the topics to be discussed and that they're highlighted in this slide right here, discussion topics. And as Marty said, at the end of this, we'll break into groups and discuss these in more detail. The objective of this session is to try to answer any questions you all might have about the briefing paper or what our objectives were, so feel free to interrupt me with any questions as we go along. I built some time into this presentation. So first, let's discuss identifying and assessing risks of material misstatement. In general, auditors respond to assess risk of material misstatement by performing audit procedures in response to risk. The PCAOB standard on fraud requires the auditor to evaluate whether identified risks of material misstatement due to fraud are related to specific financial statement accounts. The standard notes that certain accounts, classes of transactions, and assertions have high inherent risk because they involve a high degree of management judgment and subjectivity. And they also may present risks of material misstatement because they are susceptible to manipulation by management. The standard notes as an example that assets resulting from investing activities may be deemed to have a high inherent risk because of the subjectivity and management judgment involved in estimating the fair values. And collateralized debt obligations and mortgage-backed securities come to mind as examples of such assets. Revenue recognition is an area where the fraud standard requires the auditor to ordinarily presume that there is a risk of material misstatement due to fraud. The staff believes that for certain fair value measurements, there might also be a presumed risk of material misstatement due to fraud. In particular, fair value measurements with a high degree of measurement uncertainty could be presumed to represent a risk of material misstatement. Examples of indicators that might help an auditor evaluate whether there is a high degree of measurement uncertainty are on page 8 of the briefing paper. For example, an indicator could be that there is a wide range of potential valuations based on the sensitivity of the estimate. In other words, a small change in an assumption could result in a significant change in the valuation. And this would be a situation where an assumption is very sensitive to small changes. A presumption does not mean that there is a fraud. However, the auditor's response to the assessment of risks due to fraud involved the application of professional skepticism in gathering and evaluating audit evidence. The fraud standard also includes general guidance involving the nature, timing, and extent of procedures to address fraud risk. For example, for revenue recognition, an example of a response is confirming with customers relevant contract terms and the absence of side agreements because the appropriate accounting often is influenced by such terms or agreements. A fraud risk presumption for fair value measurements with a high degree of measurement uncertainty might be appropriate because they may have high inherent risk and a high amount of management judgment and subjectivity. For example, related to subjectivity, in estimating the fair value of a financial statement asset in a market that is not active, the use of a reporting entity's own assumptions about future cash flows and appropriately risk-adjusted discount rates is acceptable when relevant observable inputs are not available. This means that an entity can use its own assumptions when observable inputs are not available. An entity's own assumptions could be very subjective. So in the breakout sessions, three questions will be discussed related to a fraud risk presumption for fair value measurements with a high degree of measurement uncertainty. The first question is, should there be a requirement for the auditor to presume that a fair value measurement with a high degree of measurement uncertainty is a fraud risk? And then the follow-on question to that is, would such a requirement enhance the auditor's ability to identify the types of material misstatements that could occur? The second question is, would a requirement for the auditor to perform specific procedures similar to those contained in the fraud standard concerning revenue recognition, like I just mentioned, confirmations, in response to the risk of fair values with a high degree of measurement uncertainty, would that improve the auditor's ability to identify the types of material misstatements that could occur? And the last question is, would consideration of the factors in the briefing paper assist the auditor in evaluating which accounting measurements have a high degree of measurement uncertainty? So I'll pause right there just to see if anybody has any questions about the first topic, the fraud risk presumption. Okay. Okay, Damon Silvers?
I mean, do we know anything, or can you tell us anything about what inspections tell us in relation to the, I gather, the staff's concerns about these issues?
I don't think we can say too much more than what was put out in a 4010 report in terms of with some commentary on this issue that fair value, in many cases, fair values, especially fair values with a high degree of measurement uncertainty, in some cases, you know, the auditors and audits inspected failed to show the professional skepticism that one would expect for those circumstances. So what that would lead us to conclude is, well, if we raise the bar, if you would, that said that fair values with a high degree of measurement uncertainty were perceived to be potentially risks of material misstatement for fraud, that would at least raise the bar in terms of the audit procedures and focus that would have to be placed on that. So that's what informs this topic.
Thank you.
The next section of the briefing paper is on evaluating the adequacy of fair value disclosures. Fair value disclosures have become increasingly important for investors in determining and understanding a company's financial position and operating results. Recently issued accounting standards of the Financial Accounting Standards Board and the International Accounting Standards Board include disclosure requirements that provide users with more qualitative information about the nature of a company's objectives, assumptions, and methods associated with fair value. For example, FASB Codification Topic 820 on fair value states that, quote, the reporting entity shall disclose information that enables users to assess, close quote, for recurring fair value measurements, the inputs used to develop those fair value measurements, and for recurring fair value measurements using significant unobservable inputs, the effect of the measurement on earnings for the period. Now, this example and others are start on page 10 of the briefing paper. In addition, the FASB proposed an amendment to the fair value standards in August that would require an entity to disclose, quote, the total effects of changes in reasonably possible alternative inputs, close quote. The FASB stated in the exposure draft that for fair value measurements using significant unobservable inputs, if changing one or more of those inputs to reasonably possible alternative inputs would increase or decrease the fair value measurement significantly, sometimes referred to as sensitivity disclosures, the reporting entity would state that fact and disclose the total effects of the changes on the fair value measurements. And this was proposed in August. I'm not sure how far along the FASB is in their thinking on this, whether or not they still believe this. So I wonder if Peter might be able to share some information on that.
Sure, Greg. The comment period ended October 12th, just a couple of days ago, and I checked at midday, and there were just over 100 comments posted to our website. I'm sure there's additional comments that are in the pipeline that haven't been posted. So the staff is busy going through all those comments, and that will take a little time, although we've been through a chunk of them already. The staff will be analyzing those comments, and among the alternatives that we've been talking about, and again, I caution, this is the staff. We've not talked to the board about this. The staff is, you know, obviously we could go ahead with the sensitivity disclosure. We're calling it more of a range of possible fair values now rather than sensitivity. Or we could go ahead with that requirement but provide some scope outs. For example, private companies. Some of the comment letters we have read indicate a different need for investors or lenders in private companies. Possible additional scope outs that we're talking about include scoping out some non-financial assets and liabilities, goodwill and assets and liabilities that arise in a business combination. We're also talking about an option that would not prescribe quantitative ranges of possible fair values, but more emphasis on describing and providing some data around the inputs and the methodology, beefing up that requirement. There's also a school of thought that says, in light of IFRS 7 being in full effect at the end of 2009, maybe we should step back and use application of that standard as the Petri dish, as an expanded field test. We did a field test as part of the exposure draft, but one avenue we might consider is delaying in effect to get the benefit of what the ISB has done.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Peter. Appreciate that. Although not necessarily related to fair value, FASB Statement 166, Accounting for Transfers of Financial Assets, includes a plain English principles-based disclosure requirement. That standard provides that the disclosure shall be presented in a manner that clearly and fully explains to financial statement users the transferor's risk exposure related to the transferred financial assets and any restrictions on the assets of the entity. And here's the plain English principles-based disclosure requirement. The entity must strike a balance between obscuring important information as a result of too much aggregation and excessive detail that may not assist financial statement users to understand the entity's financial position. For example, an entity shall not obscure important information by including it with a large amount of insignificant detail. Similarly, an entity shall not disclose information that is so aggregated that it obscures important differences between the different types of involvement or associated risks. So this requirement seems to indicate that an entity should not obscure important information through notes that are too detailed or too aggregated. Based on this accounting requirement, it seems like the auditor should evaluate whether a company's notes are obscuring important information through, one, too much aggregation, or two, obscuring important information by including a large amount of insignificant detail. The fair value auditing standard contains fairly strong requirements for evaluating whether fair value disclosure is in conformity with the applicable accounting requirements, but that standard was written almost 10 years ago. One of the strong parts of the standard is that when auditing fair value measurements and related disclosures, the auditor ordinarily performs essentially the same types of audit procedures as those employed and auditing a fair value measurement recognized in the financial statements. And what that means is that the level of effort for auditing the footnotes should be the same as auditing the financial statements. As good as these requirements are, they may need to be enhanced to enable the auditor to sufficiently evaluate the qualitative and other accounting disclosure requirements. If the fair value amendment were to go through as proposed, for example, the auditor would be required to evaluate whether a disclosed alternative input is, one, reasonable, and two, reasonably possible. In addition, this accounting disclosure requirement seems to indicate a more active response to evaluating disclosures. This seems to require what is known as an understatement test. In other words, are there reasonably possible alternative inputs that a company did not consider? In addition, all these accounting disclosures seem to indicate the auditor should evaluate the understandability of disclosures. So based on all this discussion, we're asking the breakout groups to discuss one question, basically. Given the movement towards more qualitative disclosures about assets and liabilities measured at fair value and the related risks and disclosures about sensitivity of certain assumptions, is there a need for additional requirements for evaluating the adequacy of disclosures? And again, I'll pause here to see if there's any questions. Okay. Well, the last section is on using the work of a specialist. Lynn Turner.
Greg, I got a question for you. As part of the inspection process, have, as the board or the members of the staff, looked at the number of hours that people spend on auditing the footnotes where there is a significant amount of information that investors use and some very important information. That's why it goes in the footnotes. And, of course, these footnotes have gotten longer as business has got into a lot more activities and a lot more complexity. But have you looked at the hours? And if so, what percentage of those hours are versus auditing the numbers in the financial statements? Because my guess would be that if you looked at it, there are very few and a very insignificant portion of the hours actually spent on auditing the footnotes. And if that were the case, then that would tell me that, yeah, you probably got something that you need to do with the standard.
That's my knowledge. I don't think the inspectors are capturing that information when they do their inspections.
Well,
around the room.
Yeah, I don't know if they are or not, but we don't have that information available today. It's a good question, and we'll take a look into it, but we don't have that information available today.
Lynn Coleman?
I was just going to say, if you're going to look into it, I think that you need to think about it broadly, because, Lynn, I think when you do that, you got to think in terms of organizations have systems, processes, and other things that are looked at as part of an integrated audit, and then you have outputs, right? So I think you just need to be careful in any analysis that you do, you know, what conclusions you draw.
Okay, Jeff Mahoney?
Thanks, Greg. Just a couple general comments. So first, I would note that the challenges that auditors face in auditing fair value measurements that have a high degree of measurement uncertainty, as described in the memo, do not appear to be entirely new or unique challenges for the auditing profession. For example, auditors have, since 1992, have been required to audit fair value measurements for all financial instruments, including many that don't have readily available market prices. Also point, I see Jim Croker's gone, but in Jim's SEC report, December of 2008, in a study on mark-to-market accounting, all 200-some pages of it, he pointed out in that report that challenges presented by auditing fair value measurements are very similar to the challenges that auditors have long faced in connection with auditing impairments, loan loss reserves, and even depreciation expense in estimating the lives of depreciable assets. That said, to the extent that there's information from the inspection process or otherwise that indicates that the audits of fair value measurements are deficient in some manner, and that deficiency can be addressed through improving the auditing standards, I fully support that effort. Since I believe the information that results from fair value measurements, together with robust disclosures in the area of financial instruments, provides investors far more accurate, timely, and comparable information across different firms and positions than information that results from using the main alternative, which is the amortized cost approach. The Council issued a white paper in July of last year, available on our website, www.cii.org, entitled Understanding Issues Raised by the Credit Crunch, which was prepared by Stephen Ryan of Stern School of Business at NYU, that goes through in quite a bit of detail on contrasting fair value measurements to amortized cost measurements for financial instruments and describes the differences, with the conclusion that with respect to financial instruments, fair value measurements with robust disclosures provide investors far more useful information. Thank you.
Okay, thanks, Jeff. Greg Jonas?
A question. It's clear to me how auditors go about considering errors in the basic financial statements with formal policies of how those errors are posted to schedules, aggregated, and then looked at individually and in total. It's less clear to me how practice is looking at errors, discovered errors in footnotes. Do you have any inspection intelligence that of how the firms are looking at those errors, and do you have any concerns with what you found?
I think that's another area where we don't have any data, but we can certainly look into that. Sam Ranzilla? Or wait a minute, I'm sorry. Damon Silvers.
Sam, were you commenting on Greg's point?
I was going to try to at least give you one firm's perspective. When we accumulate audit differences or differences relative to the financial statements, we actually have a category called disclosures, and all the disclosures that we think are either missing or inappropriate are cataloged in there, and the engagement partner, along with the engagement quality reviewer and others, if consultation is necessary, will look at those matters within the context of the financial statements taken as a whole and conclude whether or not we need to modify our auditor's report absent some action taken by the preparer.
Okay. Damon Silvers?
I think, as many of you know, I'm a pretty profound skeptic about the idea of fair value as a universal financial accounting paradigm. I've always felt, however, that fair value is an appropriate way of valuing types of assets that have the, in circumstances that are most appropriate to it, meaning financial instruments with liquid markets held in context where they're likely to be traded. The experience of the last 2 years has convinced me that the situation of the application of fair value to financial institutions in our economy today is one in which we say that we are doing fair value and in fact are not. And that's probably the worst possible thing to do. There are, I think, powerful arguments that financial institutions, particularly depository institutions with assets, with liabilities that could be called at any time, which on the other hand hold, relatively liquid financial instruments on their balance sheet as the assets with which to meet those liabilities, that is the paradigm of the sort of circumstance where fair value is most appropriate. And that we've clearly, basically, through interpretations of FAS 157, we are not doing fair value in those circumstances. And that, in a way, the analogy that was drawn a few moments ago to impairment is a little off, meaning that in a historical cost accounting world, you kind of had very broad, you sort of had a paradigm where at some point you had to acknowledge that the asset wasn't worth what you booked it at and what you were amortizing it at. In a fair value world, you can move the numbers around, right, without having to make a sort of major acknowledgement of that kind. And for those reasons, I think that the type of world we have built, I think in large part mistakenly, is a world where the board really must do the sort of exercise that the board is contemplating here. I don't think, however, that I think we shouldn't kid ourselves. If the rules continue to be this kind of pretend regime in which we pretend that we are valuing assets according to market prices, and in fact we are not. Instead we are basically saying the asset is worth whatever you think it's worth, whatever you say it's worth, because that's the most convenient answer. Because in fact nobody wishes to face what would happen if you actually did a hard mark on these assets. Right? As long as the entire model of our financial system is let's pretend, it's not clear to me that the board it's not clear to me that you are positioned to fix that. But that doesn't mean it's not a good thing to try. So my point of my comment is to commend you for doing this. It's absolutely necessary, but I'm not terribly optimistic it will be successful.
Damon, I just have one follow-on question. Is your commentary based upon some of the same reports that you mentioned earlier that you referred to us?
Yes, it is. And it's also based on something else, which is the rather astounding fact that on one and the same time, you see our largest financial institutions crowing to the world that they are recording record profits and that they're healthy and that everything is fine. And then the people who know the most about them, right, who have inside access to their financials in a way that no public investor does. Right. Their bank regulators, the bank regulators, the Federal Reserve, and the Treasury Department won't let those same institutions return TARP money because clearly they view them as too weak.
Thank you. I think in the interest of time, Joe, you're back up again. Okay, Joe Carcello.
My comment's not as interesting as Damon's. I have a question for Sam, though. Sam, I appreciate you sharing how you evaluate issues with disclosure, and I might have misunderstood you. But my read of Staff Accounting Bulletin 99 is that if there's essentially an intentional error in the financial statement numbers, virtually automatically it's material. Because why would management have made the error intentionally if it didn't matter? So if you come across a disclosure that's missing, not necessarily one where you would prefer different wording, but a disclosure that's missing, why wouldn't you view that as an intentional error and require correction?
Well, I think, again, you make a presumption that if somebody missed a disclosure, they're immediately in fraudulent financial reporting. It's a little of a long stretch for me to make, Joe. I'm sorry. If I have other reasons after I investigate why a disclosure is missing, so for example, if a preparer left out on a 70 row column, missed one column, I don't immediately go into fraudulent auditing, pull out SAB 99, and engage, an outside party to do an investigation. I usually try to get more passes.
But wouldn't you make them fix it if it was an honest mistake?
Is it material to the financial statements taken as a whole?
Okay. Huh.
I was just going to echo what Sam said, which was the first thing he asked to do is determine whether the disclosure was material to the financial statements as a whole. And there are a lot of clients that would intentionally exclude disclosures that are not material to the financial statements. That doesn't mean it's a fraud. And that would not be evaluated in the context of the fraud standards.
They would intentionally exclude them because what?
They would say it's not material. It's not meaningful to the investor. I mean, there are a lot of disclosures that are required, but every accounting standard says you have to apply it in the context of whether it's material or not.
Of course.
Okay.
I'm not sure if Lynn or Larry are responding to Jim. Okay, Larry.
Yeah, I was just going to give that. That example of we do intentionally use summarized disclosure on our defined benefit pension plan disclosures because we traditionally did not have a defined benefit pension plan. We inherited it in an acquisition. The plan is frozen. We give information that we think is relevant about that plan in terms of its funded status, et cetera, but the disclosure requirements got so extensive in pension plans that we make a conscious decision about trying to make our financial statements informative and readable to a user community that's interested in certain aspects of them. And actually, we've had these discussions with the SEC staff in their review of our filings, and it's very common that struggle with the detailed, disclosure requirements that keep on getting seemingly get added on over and over again in terms of if you followed and literally tried to deal with every one of them, your financial statements would become unwieldy. So, we've interpreted the materiality box to give us exactly that leeway to say what is most important to an investor and you make your decisions about what's material, what's not material. So, it's not like we're trying to do fraudulent or hide anything. We're trying to make it more usable to the user community.
Okay, thank you, Larry. Lynn Turner?
First of all, two points back to the conundrum that Damon talked about, I think he does raise an interesting point with the fair value being where it is and where it's gone over the last 2 years. To some extent, especially since April, it does seem that what Damon has said is true. There's a real question now as to whether or not you're getting fair value on some of the data that we're seeing coming out in more recent months since the changes in April seem to indicate that it is almost pick a number, any number, rather than getting to real fair value. And in that environment, I too applaud you for trying to do something, but what you can do, I think, is questionable, because if the basic accounting standard doesn't get you there, auditing it probably isn't going to get you there either. It's going to be a real problem. On the second point, on the footnotes and the missing footnotes, to me, as an institutional investor, I'd be very concerned if an investor intentionally left out material information to the investor. I would put that in the fraud category without a doubt. What Sam and Jim tee up is a valid point. If it's a nickel and dime type number, people aren't going to particularly care about it, but it does raise the same question Jonas did, and that is, how are you guys assessing what would be considered to be material information to investors? And do you ever reach out to investors and ask them whether something would be significant or not, especially if it's in borderline type cases? And how do you go about making that assessment today, and what communication is there with investors to assess whether a disclosure, especially in borderline cases, would be material or not? Are you making that judgment in a vacuum with yourself and management and not with investors?
Jim Schnur? Lynn, I think to respond to your question, a lot of times when we assess whether something's material to the financial statements, we look at the information that analysts are putting in their reports as to what they think is important for purposes of analyzing the company. I can't say that we do that in every particular case, but we do it quite frequently, is to look at what the analysts are saying about the metrics of the company that drive the business, and therefore what's important to their analysis of the company.
Yeah, Greg, can you kind of wrap up this discussion so we can move to break, and thank everybody for the input.
Okay, yeah, the next topic is the use of the work of using the work of a specialist. Our specialist standard defines a specialist as a person or a firm possessing special skill or knowledge in an area other than accounting or auditing, and it can include actuaries, appraisers, engineers, environmental consultants, and geologists, and it also includes valuation experts. Specialist standard applies to specialists that are engaged by the auditor, which for the purpose of this briefing paper we're referring to them as outside specialists. However, for a specialist employed by the auditor, which we're calling employee specialists, the standard on planning and supervision applies to those types of specialists. Now, an employee specialist and an outside specialist are often used for the same purpose, which is to use a specialist's work as evidence in the audit. For example, the auditor could use an outside specialist or an employee specialist for evaluating the reasonableness of assumptions and methods in a fair value measurement. However, the specialist standard and the supervision standard have different requirements for the specialist. So essentially our question is should the same requirements apply for using an outside specialist and an employee specialist? In terms of evaluating the work of a specialist, our specialist standard, which applies to the outside specialist, has some requirements. Number one, obtain an understanding of the methods and assumptions used by the specialist. Number two, make appropriate tests of data provided to the specialist. And three, evaluate whether the specialist's findings support the related assertions in the financial statements. Regarding these requirements for evaluating the work of the specialist, the staff believes that the requirements could be improved. There continue to be inspection findings related to the use of specialists, and these findings could be related to the fact that it might not be completely clear what is meant by obtain an understanding of the methods and assumptions of the specialist. By contrast, the fair value auditing standard has a pretty clear requirement. It requires the auditor to evaluate the reasonableness of assumptions. Other standard setters have issued standards on using the work of an outside specialist, an employee specialist. For example, the IAASB issued a standard using the work of an auditor's expert. So the staff believes that a proposed standard could enhance the requirements for the auditor's evaluation of the work of the specialist and provide additional direction beyond that, which is in the specialist standard. So our last question is, what additional direction should a standard provide when evaluating the work of a specialist engaged by the auditor, given that the auditor engages a specialist since he or she does not have the requisite specialized knowledge or skills?
Okay. I think we're running a little bit late going through this, but I think it was worthwhile to get a robust discussion here about some of the issues with the group at large. Our plan now is to break and then to be in the breakout rooms. Let's try to get there at about 5 minutes after three, five or 10 minutes after three. And the break, those were handed out to everybody, right, Bella?
And they're on the breakout room assignments were emailed to the SAG members and observers. They're up on the slides, and there's also on the left-hand side in your folder, you have copies of that. There will be individuals outside helping you get to the breakout sessions. They are actually in the same rooms where you had lunch today, and so hopefully you're familiar with that room. If you can pick up all of your belongings when you're moving into that room to make sure you don't forget anything. For those individuals, because the breakout sessions are close to the public, a summary will be provided tomorrow at 8:30 as to what happened in the different breakout sessions. And also, we're going to be having actually new copies of the fair value measurements and use of a specialist briefing paper available to you in the breakout sessions, and then at the registration table, the ones that were handed out earlier today seem to be missing the even pages, and we thought that, you know, instead of having you guys try to figure out what was said on the other pages you didn't have, we would try not to stump you in the late afternoon. But feel free to get something to drink, something to eat, to re-energize yourself, and we'll, for the SAG members and observers, get into the breakout sessions about 10 after 3. Thank you very much. Marty, anything else?
That's it. Look forward to seeing you all at the breakouts.